coming to support the man that's going to win the elections.
They're awaiting the king of the country. The NP government have messed up the economy of this country all these years.
Friday, 22nd April 1994, ANC President Nelson Mandela is about to speak on the floor of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. It's Africa's biggest investment institution. The moment is crucial. There are only a few days left before South Africa's first multiracial elections. The country desperately needs to woo foreign investors. They fled apartheid in the face of heightened sanctions and political violence. Former JSE President Roy Anderson remembers how Mandela tried to allay market fears.
Inevitably, because he had a full schedule, he arrived late. I was a bit stressed and was ready to rush him onto the floor. And he turned around to me and said, "Relax, get into the car, let me get to know you." When he got onto the floor of the JSE, the world's cameras were there, all the major networks. And he absolutely charmed them. One must bear in mind that the ANC's economic policies in 1994 weren't totally clear. But by the end of the presentation, everybody was convinced that South Africa was going to prosper.
Nelson Mandela confirms that a free market economy is on the cards. His message spreads optimism among traders and investors. Mandela also promises that an ANC government won't plunge the country into chaos.
There are prophets of doom who say that after the results of the election have been announced, Africans in particular are going to run wild, destroy property, attack human beings, especially the minority. We'll dismiss those rumors without hesitation.
Large deposits of diamonds, gold, platinum and coal, among other minerals, have sustained South Africa's vibrant economy for many years. Over 600 companies are listed on the stock exchange. But sanction-led isolation during the apartheid era has battered the economy. Mandela's government of national unity introduces new socio-economic policies.
The ANC's reconstruction and development program provides a clear framework of national goals to kickstart the economy, create jobs, and provide a better life for all South Africans. The key elements of our RDP are better management of the country's resources and more effective use of its savings.
Nelson Mandela appoints trade unionist Jay Naidu to implement government's reconstruction and development program in 1994. They first met on the 11th of February 1990 when Mandela walked out of the Victor Verster prison at Paarl in the Western Cape.
We had arrived earlier that morning to help with the preparations for his release. The amazing thing was that when we walked in the door, he said, "Welcome, I want to show you the home that I have been in." He took us on a tour of his home. This is when the whole world is waiting to see him being released. He is showing us where he had been in prison and then making sure that we had tea and biscuits. So I think my first impression was of someone who has enormous presence, almost a regality, but at the same time an incredibly compassionate and humble person.
Jay Naidu says Mandela's team had to overcome many difficulties in order to rebuild the economy.
We had inherited a country that had suffered decades of an economic downturn where jobs were lost, investment in new factories was down, foreign investors were not investing because of sanctions and exports were down. So essentially, when he came to power, the country was bankrupt.
Economist and former Finance Deputy Director General Andre Roux also hasn't forgotten his first Mandela moment.
I met him after a cabinet meeting. We had a beautiful photograph taken on the steps of one of the buildings, and he joined the whole team and made some very complimentary remarks about the treasury team. You could immediately sense the greatness of the man.
Andre Roux says the Mandela administration inherited a financial nightmare.
Financial management in the first few years of that transition also broke down. New people coming in, systems didn't talk to one another. Government needed to stabilize its expenditure. And so I think President Mandela had a sense that there was a need for some stabilization.
Some people believe that the apartheid government wants to sabotage its democratic successor. Neil Coleman is a labor specialist.
When Mandela's government came into power, it took over an economy which had been wrecked in many ways by apartheid. But also importantly, the minority regime under de Klerk's leadership had actually deliberately set in place what we can call economic booby traps for the new government.
These booby traps include privatizing key state institutions such as the petrochemical giant Sasol and the leading steel producer ISCO. With diminished assets, Mandela is forced to knock on many international doors.
I have met at the president of the World Bank 3 times. I have met at the president of the International Monetary Fund. I have met at the leading commercial banks in the industrial countries. I have met every head of state, and my request has been the same. We want resources in order to develop the economy of our country. I am interested in economic stability in this country.
Nelson Mandela appoints a banker, Chris Liebenberg, as his second finance minister. Their first meeting is also burnt to memory.
My first confrontation with Mr. Mandela was when he made noises about the nationalization of banks. At that stage, I was the chief executive of a bank, and naturally, I didn't think it was a very good idea. So I asked to see him. And what struck me about him is that he has a very open mind to listen to advice and to be not afraid to change his mind.
Mandela's government signs bilateral trade agreements with some of the world's major economies almost every month during the first year of his presidency. In 1994 alone, nearly $15 billion American dollars flow into the country from the United States, Great Britain, Australia and the European Union. Chris Liebenberg says South Africa's economy made a sharp U-turn with Mandela in the driver's seat. He explains the magic of Mandela.
Countries and companies that previously avoided South Africa wanted to become associated and supported in the development of the economy through aid funds and generally through investment. Capital started flowing into the country. We immediately went to a 3% growth rate. As a result of the policies that was introduced during that period, the inflation rate dropped and the current account deficit also was eradicated.
Mandela introduces policies to address imbalances. They include affirmative action and employment equity. He also champions strong relations among government, business and labor.
We will work with business to see that more of the country's investment funds are used to create jobs.
Standard Bank is one of the companies with which Mandela partners. The bank's former director, Ruel Khoza, recalls how it came to build a school in a poor community for Mandela.
I remember Conrad Strauss breaking the news at a board meeting. The tone of voice was, "We have no choice in the matter because it is so compelling." And in virtually no time, he and a few of our board members and Mr. Mandela were visiting the site where the school had to be built.
Former Anglo-American Corporation Chief Executive Bobby Godsell refers to himself as an activist pensioner. Godsell says Mandela's charm, charisma and astuteness were extraordinary.
I recall being summoned. He was in hospital just for some routine tests. I went off to his sick bed and we discussed the issue at hand, but I'd taken a copy of The Long Walk to Freedom, which I was quite keen for him to sign, but I also didn't really feel like asking him to sign, so I kind of hid the book behind my back. And eventually he said, "For God's sake, Bobby, bring out the book and let me sign it." It was a disarming charm. It's his capacity to recognize the humanity in other people and respond to it. That's the unique thing.
Godsell also says that Mandela exploited white guilt and insecurities. His proudest moments include saying no to Madiba's numerous social fundraising requests simply because they didn't appear to be systemically sustainable, and Mandela never held it against him.
I think his attitude to leadership was a deeply personal one, so that he tended to focus on problems individually. If he visited a poor area, he phoned a businessman to build a school. But whether that school was ever incorporated into the provincial education department's budget, whether there were teachers and books regularly, he was not good on systems or on detail. So I don't think this man is, like any other human being this side of heaven, perfect.
By 1996, government starts adding different building blocks to its reconstruction and development program. It adopts a new strategy for growth, employment, and redistribution. It's better known as GEAR. Andre Roux helps to shape GEAR. The aim of the macroeconomic strategy, he says, was to coordinate the activities of the Reserve Bank, Treasury, and the Departments of Labor, Trade, and Industry.
In 1996, the outlook for our economy began to deteriorate quite sharply. One was obviously concerned about that given the new democracy, the young economy and expectations and so on. So there was also a sense that maybe we should signal to the world that on the whole, macro management was going to be done in a reasonably stable and sensible manner.
Neil Coleman says some senior ANC members masterminded GEAR. In their view, the country needs a more defined economic policy.
Within a year of coming into power, already certain key economic ministers under the leadership of the then Deputy President Thabo Mbeki were indicating a very different economic direction. And I think this then laid the basis for the adoption of GEAR in 1996. This was something which President Mandela himself was not personally driving. I think he, in good faith, left it to the economists within the cabinet, including the deputy president and other economic ministers such as Alec Irwin and Trevor Manuel, to drive these shifts in economic policy. And he was assured that this would take forward the reconstruction and development program.
Andre Roux says Mandela added a personal touch to GEAR.
He received advance copies of the final documents, read through it very, very carefully. And with President Mandela, you would always make a larger font print for him. So it was printed on A3 pages, and he sent back a document which, on the margin, was fully annotated where he felt we should emphasize slightly different.
Neil Coleman says the ANC's alliance partners feared that GEAR was serving the interests of international funding institutions rather than ordinary South Africans.
The World Bank had a key functionary who was in the GEAR drafting team, and the bureaucracy within Treasury and other government departments were also playing a very key role in driving economic policy in a particular direction. So really the ANC did not have its hands on the levers of economic power, and it was, if you like, an experiment which went badly wrong.
September 1997, the Labour Federation COSATU holds its 6th National Congress in Kempton Park, east of Johannesburg. The trade unionists sing Mandela's praises just like they did during his election campaign. But they also have a bond to pick with him. "We don't want GEAR," they sing. The late COSATU president John Komomo describes the macroeconomic strategy as the reverse GEAR. Mandela defends it, but concedes that the drafting process has been flawed.
"Although we regard GEAR as an important document, if our allies are unhappy about it, then we must take note. It was unfortunate that in GEAR we did not have sufficient consultation with other members of the alliance. In fact, I must confess that even the ANC learnt of GEAR when it was almost complete. So we in the government ignored those who actually put us in power. And there is nothing as more dangerous as the government forgetting its constituency."
Jane Aidu still believes that it was a big mistake to close the RDP office in the presidency.
"The RDP represented a vision that the poor had, that they were hopeful of a better life. And we lost the momentum, and in fact we lost a very important social consensus which had really won us our freedom."
Businesswoman and former anti-apartheid activist Dr. Mampela Rampele first met Nelson Mandela at Polsmoor Prison in Cape Town in mid-1988.
"I had no concept of just how tall and how well-built he was and how trim he was for a man of his age. As he walked into the sitting room in Polsmoor, it was like you get hooked on the man and the aura around him. It was truly an electrifying moment. I just felt I was in the presence of greatness.
Ramphele says the economy benefited enormously from his ability to lobby prominent figures.
Without Mandela's stature and persuasiveness, it would have been very difficult to get the markets to see South Africa as distinct from the failures of Africa. But Mandela inspired that confidence. Also, Mandela's power and persuasiveness helped to support Thabo Mbeki and Trevor Manuel and the other people in the economic team to get the ANC to move away from the old-style centrist economic planning to recognize that they are part of the 20th century that was entering into the 21st, where global integration and competitiveness was the order of the day.
Valetsi Gaulati was the governor of the Bank of Botswana during the Mandela era. Gaulati says his luster made Southern Africa shine.
He played a very, very important role in the democratization of South Africa, and then also in putting our region on the map, especially the SADC region. It was, for instance, during his time that countries like the DRC were admitted to SADC.
Veteran entrepreneur Richard Maponya first met Mandela during the early years of the ANC Youth League in the 1940s. Maponya says Mandela and his late mentor Walter Sisulu recruited him to the former liberation movement. This is how he views Mandela's contribution to the economy.
If at all, it was not the blood and sweat of black people contributing in terms of their labor, this country would never have been what it is. He therefore said, we are not going to destroy what we have built. To me, that was a wonderful wisdom, because had we revenged, maybe South Africa, it would have been like the ruins of Zimbabwe.
Maponya says Mandela inspired black businesses to trade on the stock exchange. They included the now defunct New African Investments Limited, Real Africa Holdings Limited, and MTN. The wealth of a few black business people starts growing.
For the first time, we began to see black companies listing in the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and becoming a part of the economic arena.
By the time Nelson Mandela prepares to retire from active politics, the economies of the Asian Tigers have exploded. Their demand for South Africa's commodities dwindles. The price of gold tumbles to $280 an ounce in 1999. The rand weakens against major currencies. Interest rates escalate to about 26% in late 1998, the highest level ever recorded in the country's history. Unemployment rises. Investor confidence is knocked due to uncertainty surrounding the economy without Mandela at the helm. But by the turn of the century, the economy recovers. Because, as Dr. Mamphele Ramphele puts it, Mandela and his team cemented the flow.
And I don't know that anybody could have pulled it together other than this towering transformational figure in world history. In South African terms, he was the man who made us whole and made us hopeful again.